Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
So it threatens all of us because they don't care who they're targeting as long as there's social disruption.
According to Dr. Mike Kelly, social media sites are being weaponized in ways that fuel division and hatred toward different ethnic groups, leading to a sharp increase in anti-Semitism across the nation. Stay tuned for this story and more coming up on The Wire. US President Donald Trump has been losing patience with the response Vladimir Putin has been providing to his overtures to end the war on Ukraine. He has shortened his time for a suitable response from Russia and has moved to include 50% tariffs on Indian imports unless they stop buying Russian oil. I asked UTS industry professor and chief economist Tim Harcourt whether it would be just India and China that would be targeted by the US.
India, China, Turkey, the EU, but principally, yes, China and India. And that, of course, causes some complications in a sense because, Trump has been trying to move trade away from China towards India. But, of course, India has a huge trade with Russia in terms of oil.
And they've also got other relationships too, going back years on defence and so forth, haven't they?
Yeah, well, Indira Gandhi with the non-aligned movement was pretty close to the Soviet Union, and probably less so today, but they are one of the BRICS economies, and that seems to be a block in a way. I'd say it's more frenemies. I don't think there's any love between them. It's more partnership of convenience.
The objective is, of course, to weaken the Russian economy to try and get Putin to pull back from the war in Ukraine. How effective do you think this might be?
Well, hasn't been so far. Probably because Russia's been able to get past the sanctions through its partnership with China and India and Iran too, you've got to say, although they've now been weakened. So they've got to try something. And, defence spending in Russia is 6% of GDP. They really do. They are really cranking up to Soviet Union levels of defence spending.
And is this going to make then world oil prices go up, do you think?
Oh, most likely. There'll be more disruption to the global economy at a time when India was going quite well with the United States, but their recent disputes over trade has made it very difficult, and this will just add to that.
Is Vladimir Zelensky, do you think, in favour of this approach, or would he rather get, armaments and things?
Oh, I think anything to weaken Russia, he'd be in favour. He's still battling to hold them at bay. The only good thing is that, in some ways, the pressure that Trump's put on the European Union has helped, Ukraine a bit, because they've started to pull a bit more weight now instead of having to rely just on the Americans for support. So there's a bit more from Europe and the UK that wasn't happening before.
Which countries in the European Union are getting the Russian oil?
Not Germany.
They don't have any bans on receiving Russian oil, but they do on gas, do they?
Well, they're a little bit cagey about it, the EU, and they've been in Australia looking at green hydrogen and all sorts of things to replace it. But I think oil, gas, nuclear is still part of the German energy future for the time being.
What sort of effects are we going to see on the world economy when we're going to have higher energy prices then having knock-on effects?
Oh, probably, but on the other hand, if it does weaken Russia, then that could, improve situations in the global economy if it brings the war to an end. But, at the moment, it's going to be pretty hard. But again, you can let Russia take Ukraine if you like, but that could be more catastrophic for the world than higher oil prices in the short term.
I suppose the big problem will be China, because US has just recently managed to change and sort of smooth over the relationship with trade with China. So if they're going to put a 100% tariff on China because of the Russian oil, that's going to open up the wound again, isn't it?
Oh, I don't think the wound's ever closed. I mean, it's clearly competitive tension. It might persuade the Chinese to tell Putin to back down, but they can tell him to do that. It doesn't mean he will.
The Russians have been making some pretty serious strikes on the Ukrainian soil in the last couple of weeks. Does that kind of indicate that Putin's really not that worried about whatever Trump's going to do?
Well, at the moment he's not, but I think, you know, given that a third of his exports are oil and gas, if the sanctions did work, then he would have something to worry about. Even a dictatorship does worry about public opinion to some extent, if the economy gets affected.
So this move could be quite effective.
If it's long enough and hard enough, probably, but depends on, you know, the reaction of China and Iran and Turkey as well.
US industry professor and chief economist Tim Harcourt speaking with me there. The launch of the Special Envoy Report into Anti-Semitism paints a disturbing picture of intolerance that has risen in Australia following the eruption of violence since the October 7 attacks. Stephen Hill asked Dr. Mike Kelly from Labor Friends of Israel how concerning the situation was in Australia when it comes to the presence of the world's oldest prejudice.
Well, it should be concerning to everyone, and I know that it is, the majority of Australians. I think that was a problem for the government last year, that they weren't realising there was a big groundswell of concern about just domestic security. Because if you talk to people in the Hindu or Sikh or Buddhist or a Thai Filipino, Pacific Islander, they know that if a synagogue burns today, it's going to be a temple or a church that burns tomorrow. There was a real worry that it wasn't being properly addressed. And I think the original sin there was that horrific moment on the 9th of October 2023, when that illegal demonstration chanting, "Where's the Jews?" and "F the Jews," etc., threatening violence, denied the Sydney Jewish community the ability to just mourn the horror and the tragedy of the savagery that was committed on the 7th of October. So when that wasn't dealt with properly, the law enforced a place made safe for that community, it sort of fed the steady escalations we saw, the vandalism, the arson.
In the report, what the Special Envoy describes as online platforms that have become vectors for conspiracy theories and hate speech, do you think more has to be done to combat the rise of intolerance that's appearing in various guises online?
Stephen, you have hit on the main point here, and it's a major focus for me. I'm an adjunct professor out at the National Security Institute at the University of Canberra, where we have been focusing on the general information warfare challenge that the West faces right now. Democracy has been under siege, it's been corroded, it's been defeated, and particularly since 2016, when Russia showed what it could achieve in getting Donald Trump elected. Then Iran and China, you know, North Korea learning those lessons, and now them coordinating amongst themselves. And I don't think a lot of people realise just how coordinated, insidious and volumised that is through the assets and the abilities of the states. That is now fueling the neo-Nazis on the right and then the most extremists and the Marxists in the middle and left. You know, it's just all over the spectrum of the threats that we face, and that's why the Australian went over to New Zealand and shot up 50 Muslims in New Zealand, that appalling incident. So it threatens all of us, because they don't care who they're targeting as long as there's social disruption.
So what I discovered is also that you yourself, when you're an elected representative, have been targeted by white nationalists with a neo-Nazi sticker from a group labelled the Antipodean Resistance. What was that experience like for yourself and your staff?
For my staff, it was deeply traumatising. And so to come to work in the morning and have one of those really confronting and offensive posters on your window of your office, you know, which you suspect that would ever happen in a place like Bega. But they did come down, and they also did homophobic attacks after the the plebiscite happened to a, we had a gay couple running the post office in Cobargo, but the community rallied and washed that stuff off their walls. They came down and put up anti-migration stuff, and then in my electorate office in Queanbeyan left pigs' entrails or something in front of the door. And now we've seen these days a lot of my former colleagues and MPs getting the same treatment, but even worse now, like Peter Carlisle, for example, his electorate office, they drilled a hole in the wall and introduced toxic materials into his office, which was highly hazardous. And so they had to get in a hazmat team. They started a fire in front of Josh Burns's electorate office in a building that had apartments.
Okay, so one of the recommendations that is receiving a lot of media attention due to potential of it being abused is the potential for the government to withdraw funding from universities, public broadcasters and cultural organisations. Is there a danger that we could end up in a situation where we've got, like in the US, where Donald Trump has withdrew $400 million from Columbia University?
Yeah, look, that needs to be handled very carefully. And you want to approach this by actually building a bit of a consensus around what's going on. Your media resources are looking for a simple black hat, white hat paradigm to squeeze things into. The simplification and the then typecasting who the players are. And I don't think there's a complete answer to that right now, but we do have to appreciate that our university landscape is problematic. There was terrible stuff going on our campuses. In some ways, this can be addressed by simply pulling together and determining what is acceptable and what isn't on a university campus, and opening universities to be what they ought to be, places of enlightenment, of debate, of reason, where you can have discussions without being shouted down, intimidated or targeted, cancelled, boycotted, etc.
Dr. Mike Kelly, former Labor member for Eden Monaro and adjunct professor in the National Security Institute at the University of Canberra, speaking with Stephen Hill. Tiny house residents are facing fines of $10,000 daily, remaining in a public battle against council after receiving a letter saying their tiny home on wheels in the Bega Valley isn't compliant. Recently, their online petition, backed by 27,000 signatures, was rejected on a technicality. Emma Watsky asked tiny homeowner Joshua Hines how they came to purchase a tiny home.
We've got 12 square metres in the whole world, and that was reasonable for us. It was an opportunity for us to work towards a bigger goal of maybe one day having our own place. Our tiny home is parked on a rural property. There's an occupied dwelling house. It's owned by an older retired couple, and they've got lots of veggie gardens and some sheep and an orchard. And so we spend plenty of time on the property helping them, and just supported us to feel comfortable and secure in the area.
In April, that sense of security changed when the couple and the landowner owners received a draft order from council stating the tiny home needs to be removed or demolished to align with New South Wales environmental planning legislation. Failure to abide could trigger legal proceedings with a potential court-imposed fine of up to $1 million. Mr. Bone took to his change.org petition, writing, "If you live in the Bega Valley, you'll have seen homelessness, limited rental stock, soaring rents and property sale prices, all contributing to people living in caravans and other movable dwellings. The couple didn't seek council permission or development approval, but say they didn't believe it was required and built based on state legislation."
The compliance staff came back to the property. They had an opportunity to see that our home was on a trailer, measure it up and understand that it's within the dimensions and weight limits of a registerable caravan. But they did issue a final order because they've determined that the structure isn't a caravan and they think it is a structure under what we have in New South Wales, which is the Environmental Protection and Assessment Act. We consider it to be a caravan, and that's a real point of contention.
In a statement to The Wire, Bega Valley Shire Council said they are not able to discuss the details of individual cases, but acknowledge strong community interest in tiny homes and movable dwellings, and need for state legislation that supports flexible housing options. Tiny homes are not defined under the New South Wales planning framework. While in some instances a caravan may be exempt, in other instances will require a DA for land use approval. Council encourages property owners to seek planning advice and say they will continue to advocate for state-led reform. Meanwhile, New South Wales Planning Minister Paul Scully told Wind News last month, when it comes to movable vehicles, ultimately it comes down to matters between the local government Act and Council's action and compliance. Years from local bushfires, Mr. Hines says clarity between local and state government on tiny homes is long overdue. In the meantime, their petition calls Council to suspend tiny home evictions.
I'm pretty disappointed. We're here 5 years after the bushfire and 2 or 3 years since our local council's declared a housing crisis, and we're still arguing about this solution.
But owners and industry say confusion and red tape around planning rules and approval processes present barriers, while experts suggest tiny homes can be subject to regulatory grey areas with inconsistencies in state laws, tiny house classification, and some councils struggling to implement these in their policies. Volunteer National President for the Australian Tiny House Association, Rochelle Ryan, echoes these views. She also points to land use and occupancy length, which create additional complexities, particularly in a housing crisis.
The reason why tiny home owners are actually living in tiny homes is because they can't afford the house and land, but they can afford a small, affordable home. In a housing crisis where you're desperate for a place to live and you can afford to either build or purchase a tiny home, you can casually live in a structure like a shed for 2 years without an issue. But if you stay beyond that second anniversary, you then go into a very unknown area.
More needs to be done at a national level to ensure consistency around tiny homes across each state as people struggle to afford housing.
Someone in Victoria, it's South Australia, Queensland, New South Wales, Tasmania, we don't have that assurity of we're not going to get that knock on the door by a local government representative, and we have to fight through the magistrate court to have a place to live.
Emeritus Professor of Planning and Urban Management at Griffith University, Paul Burton, says while tiny home living is not the single answer to the housing crisis, it could be a viable option.
Tiny homes can make a valuable contribution. They can add to the choice and the diversity of housing available. Tiny homes come in all shapes and sizes. And the most important distinction is between those that are fixed on the ground and those that are on wheels.
Burton highlights council concerns and says standards for tiny homes are vital, from environmental and building safety through to financial compliance. Meanwhile, pilot programs in Shell Harbour City Council, New South Wales, and Surf Coast Shire, Victoria, are trialling tiny home living without required development applications. Burton says programs like these could offer a pathway provided policies are adapted with changing times.
In those trials, and we will specify the areas and the zones that exist already, if you're proposing a tiny home there and you can meet these criteria, you're kind of deemed almost to have approval. It won't have to go through a lengthy and costly planning assessment process. I think those are really good initiatives by those councils.
Back in the Bega Valley, Mr. Hines says they will continue to work to understand council's determination.
Emma Watsky ending that report. We tend to think of the US as the bastion of private enterprise, but many successful businesses owe their success to government contracts. That's why the participation of Elon Musk in the presidential race kind of raised a red flag. But maybe we should be more concerned about his erstwhile business partner, Peter Thiel, who has also financed Republican candidates and who founded a company called Palantir with Alexander Karp. I asked Professor Noel Castry, Professor of Society and Environment at the University of Technology, Sydney, to explain what Palantir does.
So Palantir, it's an American tech company. It was founded in 2003. And the two most prominent senior executives are Peter Thiel, who you mentioned, and a less well-known individual called Alex Karp. The name's quite interesting, actually. The name Palantir, it refers to J.R. Tolkien's fiction and his idea of a seeing stone that can detect invisible things or find needles in haystacks. So it's a really good description of what Palantir does. So Palantir has very advanced software and hardware that allow it to mine vast amounts of data about people, join various dots and see patterns and also see exceptions, so where people are behaving differently or unusually. And you're right, Palantir, particularly in the last 2 years, has benefited enormously from federal government contracts in the US, but also outside the US. For example, it has a pretty big contract with the National Health Service in the UK. And clearly, the services it offers do give intelligence agencies, the military and others quite a lot of power, but certainly Palantir are helping to further particular intelligence, military and policing agendas in the US at the moment. Yeah.
And there's a new book out, which is the basis of your article and research in The Conversation, that's been penned by Karp and Nicholas Samistra. Coming out of this book, it's a bit hard to understand Alexander Karp and Palantir's closeness with the Trump administration when they want to imbue Silicon Valley with a moral compass.
Yeah, that's right. So this is quite interesting. So Alexander Karp, as you said, with another Palantir senior employee called Nicholas Samistra, have just published a book called The Technological Republic. It's a sort of manifesto. And it's a call to arms to other leaders of big tech companies in the United States to find a sense of national purpose, to defend what's good about America, and to protect it from its enemies, such as Russia or China. And it's interesting because Karp is rather different to Peter Thiel, his business partner. So Peter Thiel is what sometimes call an extreme libertarian. So he's a huge defender of personal freedom and people's right to live the way they want to live and do things they want to do. And obviously, he's a very wealthy man. That benefits Peter Thiel quite significantly if a society like that were to be created. Now, Alexander Karp's rather different. He was born in New York. He was raised in Philadelphia. He doesn't have a technological or a sort of computer science mathematics background. He actually did advanced degrees in law and in sociology. And his parents were quite politically active, social justice activists. So he's got a strong social conscience, I think, Alexander Karp. And I think the gist of the argument is that big tech companies need to commit to a sense of what's good about America and adapt their business models to suit that purpose. So given that, you are right, it is a little bit odd that Karp is the chief executive officer of essentially a company that deals in surveillance.
Would the dangers of a Palantir with all the information that it controls, would that equate somewhat to concerns we've had in Australia over Huawei?
Yeah, some of the concerns that are being expressed in the West about surveillance are to do with overseas surveillance. And what you're asking me is, you know, in a sense, is Palantir enabling domestic surveillance openly and transparently? And I think that is a risk. So Palantir has been quite controversial in the news in the last few months because it does work with ICE in the United States, which, of course, is at the heart of deporting illegal immigrants, but also seems to have captured and detained perfectly legal immigrants. So Palantir is linked with that. So, yes, you are right. I mean, clearly there is a concern around things like privacy, data privacy, when you have these big companies synthesizing mind-boggling amounts of data about us and our daily activities. And that's where government comes in.
So one of the ideas that's come out of this book from Karp and Samistra is that they want to have an idea of an inclusive nationalism. Would that include, on the political spectrum, people from Bernie Sanders to J.D. Vance, for example, do you think?
Yes, it's ambiguous. I think one of the odd things about the book is there is a call for tech billionaires to commit to a sense of national purpose, but the authors don't actually indicate what that would look like politically. So it's a really open question what kind of American nation they want to see come into existence in the next, say, 10 to 25 years. I'm just quoting from the back end of the book where they talk about the need to resurrect a shared culture, not abandon it, end of quote. And, you know, they advocate for what they call founder type individuals such as Steve Jobs, and in fact, Peter Thiel himself, I suppose, who are willing to be brave and say unpopular things.
Do you think that the authors of Hillbilly Elegy and The Art of the Deal will be reading this book?
That's a great question. Probably not. Probably not.
Professor Noel Castry, Professor of Society and Environment at the University of Technology, Sydney, speaking with me there. And And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.